Okay, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this evening's event, which is a book launch for an important book on the crisis, a final financial crisis manual, Reflections on the Road Ahead. It is an overview of the crisis from different disciplinary perspectives, different perspectives of practitioners as well as academics. It looks at the financial crisis as how it has impacted on Greece, how it's played in Greece, but also places that within a wider perspective as well. And we're delighted to have the three editors and main contributors here this evening. Platon Monoprousos is the Group Chief Economist and Deputy General Manager of Eurobank Egesias, and he is Chairman of the Scientific Council of the Hellenic Banking Association, and is also its representative to the Chief Economist Group of the European Banking Federation. Even more importantly than that, he's now a Senior Visiting Fellow at the Hellenic Observatory here at the LEC. Kostas Nikolopoulos is the director of the ForLab. He is an expert in time series analysis and forecasting, and he now holds the chair in decision sciences in the Bangor Business School and is the college director of research at Bangor. Dimitris Thomakos holds the chair in applied econometrics and is currently the head of the Department of Economics in the University of the Peloponnese, as well as a senior fellow and member of the Scientific Council for the Research Center for Economic Analysis in Canada. Our three editors will explain to us about the book and how they came to write it and the arguments of the book, and then we're delighted that a colleague from the LSE, Professor Dimitris Fionas, will be the discussant and will pose a number of questions and comments on the book, and then we will open it up so that there's plenty of time for Q&A with the audience. So we're delighted to host this event for clearly what is an important book appealing to a number of different audiences. And I suppose I should be the first person to emphasize that you can go online and purchase the book, and there are copies of the book which you can look at outside as well. So without further ado, can you please join me in welcoming our first speaker this evening, Platon Monoprousos.
Gentlemen, good evening. Let me first thank the LSE Hellenic Observatory for hosting tonight's event. Special thanks on behalf of the editorial team to Professor Featherstone, the head of the European Institute, and also our discussant, Professor Dimitris Vagianos, who is the head of the finance department of the LSE. And if I wanted to basically address a question of what possibly makes this book important, I would say that although many books have been written on the subject, the global financial crisis, there is a unique aspect, so to speak, in this particular book, which is the blending of the industry perspective and the academia. So this book aims to bring together the analysis, the views of prominent financial sector participants and prominent academics, and discuss the implications and of the global financial crisis and the aftermath of the global financial crisis. I will very briefly go over the content of the first nine chapters. First of all, there are three sections in this book. The first one is the industry perspective, includes contributions of a number of prominent financial sector professionals. The second part talks about Greece, the inner causes of the debt crisis. This second part includes a number of econometric studies, empirical studies, on subjects ranging from the macroeconomic effects of fiscal programs, fiscal austerity programs applied in the country over the last several years, empirical estimates of regime-dependent fiscal multipliers, and a range of other issues relevant to the crisis. The third part discusses the economic crisis from the perspective of the academia. So it includes a number of contributions from prominent professors, academics, and seasoned economists. And the book concludes with some analysis of the challenges lying ahead. So very quickly, I will start with the first chapter. The title of the first chapter is a retrospective on the Great Recession causes, effects, and prospects. The chapter was contributed by Inachos Lazos. Inachos is currently an advisor to a number of US-based hedge funds. The chapter offers a very insightful perspective, overview of the tectonic shifts that took place in the global economy in the decade leading to the global financial crisis of 2007-2009. He analyzes a number of issues, including, for instance, the so-called super debt cycle, the integration of billions of emerging market consumers in the global economy, the period that was named the period of great moderation, a long period of very low inflation and interest rates globally, since very significant savings generated in a number of emerging market economies were recycled back to the US and other advanced economies via through the leverage system, and allowed major economies, including the US, to become consumers of first and last resort, and a number of other relevant issues. The chapter also provides a very insightful analysis of investment opportunities throughout the crisis. Following the Lehman collapse, there was a very significant decline in asset prices and a huge rally in the so-called safe haven assets, including U.S. Treasury bonds, and, of course, a downward spiral in global equity markets and a skyrocketing of credit spreads. These dynamics basically become trending enough to allow a number of leveraged players, hedge funds, to basically take advantage of them. This created two challenges to global policymakers. The first challenge was to basically arrest the rapidly deteriorating macroeconomic fundamentals, and the second, never allow again market forces and speculative capital to interfere with the objective of stabilizing the macroeconomy and investment sentiment. Then, monetary authorities in the US, UK, Japan, and later on the European Central Bank provided significant monetary policy accommodation. This allowed a stabilization in sentiment and a gradual improvement in macroeconomic fundamentals. And after the initial shock, we had a renormalization trade. Of course, monetary accommodation accommodated what is a phenomenon which is can be described as financial repression, which basically triggered and allowed speculative players and many other investors, real money players, to basically very closely follow central bank activities and central bank actions. Inahos concludes with a view that the major challenge in the period following the outbreak of the global economic crisis is subpar growth and very low inflation on a global scale. The second chapter was written by Fabrice Montals. Fabrice is currently heading the UK research analysis at Barclays. The title of the chapter is European Public Finances Through the Crisis. The chapter provides a thorough analysis of the evolution of European public finances throughout the crisis. The chapter claims that the road to full monetary, full economic integration in the euro area remains long and difficult. He provides a positive assessment as regards the European Commission investment plan to basically boost investment activity in the euro area and boost employment. But concludes by noting that the real challenge is to create real fiscal space in the euro area so as to accommodate monetary and financial integration. The third chapter was written by Mr. Athanasios Varvakidis. Athanasios is heading the Global FX Strategy Team at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Athanasios provides an overview of the evolution of the European Central Bank monetary policy throughout the crisis and the period following the global financial crisis. He claims that the European Central Bank policy was strong enough to basically avert a disintegration of the euro area, but unfortunately, the European Central Bank policy stance was relatively restrictive, especially in the period before the initiation of the quantitative easing program, and this allowed basically the euro to remain strong vis-à-vis other major currencies, such as the US dollar, over the period 2012-2014. The next chapter, contributed by Ralph Schuppel, talks about the repression of financial markets. Financial repression is a generic term to describe a policy of providing cheap financing to governments. And financial repression is usually accommodated by very accommodative monetary policies. He discusses in great detail the monetary policy response of major central banks, including the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, and the European Central Bank throughout the crisis. This policy response was based on three pillars. The first pillar was the so-called quantitative easing, which aimed to basically boost the monetary base, mainly through outright purchases of sovereign debt. The second pillar was what the author calls as qualitative easing, which included outright purchases of a range of other assets, such as agency bonds and mortgage-backed securities, with the aim to compress risk premiums, especially credit spreads and interest rate term spreads. And thirdly, lastly, the other pillar of this strategy was forward guidance, an unconditional pre-commitment to future monetary policy action. So Ralph Schuppel claims that all this monetary policy accommodation, especially from the US Central Bank and to a lesser degree by Bank of England, basically contributed to financial repression, which means a prolonged period of low volatility and low and stable interest rates. In addition to that, there was a huge tightening of regulation, especially in the regulated banking sector, which included, for instance, a very significant tightening of capital regulation, and also a very tight accounting rules for pension funds and insurance companies. So this regulatory tightening actually contributed to financial repression because it encouraged, for instance, purchases of presumably safe and more safe and low not volatile, less risky assets such as treasury bonds. So this regulatory tightening actually accommodated increased financial repression, and then he continues in discussing the side effects of financial repression. And the side effects include, for instance, a weakened institutional resilience to future shocks and addiction to long duration risks. The fifth chapter, reading by Marcel Kasumovic, discusses financial repression as well, the procyclical nature of liquidity creation, and proposes a number of policies to basically increase oversight and regulation of the non-regulated banking system. The sixth chapter, written by Michael Argyrou, talks about the architecture of the euro area during the crisis and the evolution of governance after the crisis. He talks about the inner causes of the debt crisis in the euro area and a number of developments related to macroprudential policies, the creation of the single banking union, and a number of other initiatives and policies taken so as to strengthen the architecture of the euro area following the crisis. The next chapter, which was written by Plato Monoklousos, myself, and Professor Dimitris Christomakos, one of the other co-editors, is an empirical study on regime-dependent fiscal multipliers in Greece. This is one of the, it's probably the only empirical study in the literature that provides empirical estimates of the macroeconomic effects of fiscal policy on output. And it uses some econometric techniques that provide the room to make such estimates, regime-dependent fiscal multipliers. The chapter makes a number of contributions. For instance, a key finding of this study is that multipliers in Greece, in the Greek economy, tend to be higher in economic recession recessions than in periods of positive economic growth. This finding has a number of implications, especially related to the fiscal policies and the very heavily austere fiscal packages implemented in Greece over the last several years. The next chapter talks about the evolution of Greek public debt over the last several years, and it appears that there is a paradox here, because Greece has implemented a very dramatic, a very aggressive fiscal consolidation program. This program succeeded in reducing the structural fiscal balance by close to 20 percentage points of GDP over the last 6 years, And at the same time, we've seen over this period the debt to GDP ratio increasing quite significantly. If you look at the latest data, the debt to GDP ratio in Greece increased from levels around 120% before the crisis to current levels close to 180%. So this is a kind of a paradox. You apply austere fiscal policy to reduce deficits, and in the same time, the GDP ratio increases quite significantly. Of course, there is an explanation to this phenomenon. The spike in the debt to GDP ratio and the deterioration of the dynamics can be explained by the severe economic recession that took place over the last several years. So the chapter provides a quantitative analysis to basically explain this phenomenon. And the next chapter discusses the prospect of a new agreement, of a new package to relief, to provide debt relief in Greece. And actually, there is an explicit commitment in the third bailout package that was signed between Greece and the institutions, official lenders, in August 2015, explicitly promising a new debt relief from the official sector so as to make the dynamics more sustainable on a medium-term basis. This particular chapter proposes a structure to basically extend the average maturities of official loans by a significant number of years, to provide additional relief in the form of lower interest rates on old and new loans provided by the European partners, so as to make the dynamics more sustainable. And with this comment, I would like to pass the floor to the next speaker, Professor Dimitris Kornakos, to very briefly present the next three chapters.
Thank you, Vlado. Good evening from me too. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for your attendance. The buzzword for the next three chapters is that of imbalances. One of the major problems that the crisis forced many economies to face is that of imbalances of various kinds. And for the Greek economy, the word of imbalances is still very persistent, the big problem of how we are going to deal with the future. I will try to weave together the results of three chapters that relate to the current account problems for Greece and Germany, which are diametrically opposite, and the problem of the external debt evolution under incomplete markets. How are all these related? There are two chapters in the book. Let's see. This one, which is an empirical study on the Greece's current account determinants. There's also another chapter going forward. This, The Elephant in the Euro Room, by Alex Patelis, that talks about the problem of current account imbalances in Germany. What's the relationship between these two chapters? They basically tell the same story from two different angles. In Greece, as common knowledge comes out, and what the data can tell us, Greece was faced with problems of loss of competitiveness and fiscal profligacy. These are all well known, and they come out on the data very strongly. But the thing is that these two problems were mostly corrected. However, even though the problems for Greece were corrected, these particular problems for Greece for the case of the current account were corrected. And in fact, in another paper with Clayton, we did make some projections that came out quite well, if I remember correctly, for 2013, 14, and maybe 15. For the case of Germany, the claim that is made in the chapter by Alex Patelis is that these problems are not corrected. It's not a Germany busing chapter, of course, but what it says, and we can also see it in the data, is that there is the current account surplus in Germany the importation of capital instead of exportation of capital for supporting the periphery creates a problem that essentially can have negative spillovers on the distribution of risk on risky assets. So there are implications that go beyond the macroeconomic situation that we are facing in the Eurozone, and they can affect what we can see in the financial markets as well. And this brings us to the chapter in the middle, which talks about the external debt evolution when global financial markets are incomplete. This is a very interesting chapter that talks about the issue of external debt imbalances when we cannot possibly have prior knowledge and hedge for every possible risk in the financial markets. The empirical analysis of this particular chapter shows that the external debt evolution can become a non-stationary process, to put it in technical terms, a process in which does not return to any particular equilibrium, and this has significant implications on the way we understand the transmission of productivity shocks across countries. And there is a claim that the authors made based on their analysis, and this relates to the chapter, for example, the chapter of Greece, that we need to pay further attention on strengthening the domestic structures of the financial markets before we allow for further integration. One of the problems on the case of the Greek current account deficit is that Greece entered in a more integrated market without having the domestic structures that could have prevented many of the problems that we are currently seeing. And I think that I am going to stop here, not take more time, and move on to Kostas.
Sorry, we're a little bit tight here. It's all part of the performance.
Okay, so thank you for this invitation and the opportunity. Apologies for my voice, which is courtesy of one of my youngest offspring, so I have to. They apparently go over them in 2 days. I need probably 2 months to go over it, so we'll see. My task was slightly more challenging. I have to bring balance between academics and practitioners. And actually, when we said we need practitioners to see what is really happening in the market, I have to really define what we mean by practitioners. So the plan was to really have people that have seen both ends. Absolutely exceptional training, absolutely exceptional studies. So just to give you two examples, Vondakidis has a PhD from Harvard, Patelis has a PhD from Princeton. And still they are there fighting and taking the risks every day. So we wanted to see people that have seen both ends. So everybody has been very selectively and very in a very strict process. We wanted to have people that have very strong academic backgrounds. But at the same time, we wanted to give a pure academic flavor as well. And to that end, I was quite happy to have here Professor Chakravarti, that contributed a very interesting chapter from Bangor University. We had Michael Argyrou from Cardiff University, Konstantin Agotaridi from University of Piraeus. So we had academics as well that wanted to give the other end. So how academia actually sees all this that are happening in the financial sector, and what can we actually learn from this, and what can we do to improve things in the future. So to that end, I'm going to only discuss the two chapters from academics, and I'll also give some hint of the future as well. So in the first chapter, Konstantin Agotaridi, she discusses a lot about how we can mobilize and start the economy again, and she giving examples and data that make a very strong case for FDI, for innovation, and for human capital to be the three driving forces to restart the economy. What I find from an academic perspective far more interesting is that she highlights exactly the role of the university, the role that the university has to play in this process. And she discusses very extensively the brain drain phenomenon, which you see probably the best academics are probably here in this room, and many of them come from Greece, and many of them have decided not to stay in Greece and do the same thing in Greece. So we have that issue that if the best brains go out, then how can we have maybe the best available soldiers in the field to do the job in the country when we need them. And the idea was that the university can really be the force to bring these people back. So we will have to start from redoing the university, so University 101 from scratch, rebuild it in a sense so it can actually attract the top academics from Greece in the world back to the country. Then that would be an excellent start to bring the best possible human capital in the country, and then everything else will start from there. So I find that a very interesting argument, starting from rebuilding the university from scratch. And then we'll go to my dear friend here, Sandy, that do me the honor to provide a chapter on the financial crisis, which it's a very different chapter from all the other chapters because it has a very strong color, in a way, political color, and in a way it's very different from many others because it sees, also it gives a social aspect of things, of how we actually end up here, not necessarily explaining why, but dealing a lot with how we end up here, and always saying that it's much easier to see how things end up somewhere, but it's much more difficult to say why things went in a specific way. And he starts by making very strong arguments like that we were for many years in a state of denial, in such a state where we believed that Northern Rock would be giving loans of 120% of the actual property value, give you an extra 20% to repair the property and maybe pay off your personal loan as well, and we consider that to be risk-free. So that was the case. And from that point, we moved into something even worse, which Sandy defines as the state of deliberate ignorance, where we were willing to even ignore the whistleblowers, that they were saying that things in Goldman Sachs are not as nice and shiny as they look, and we prefer to have mechanisms to put them outside the game rather than really take the early indicators that something is going very wrong. He has a very, very strong example to highlight that, bringing back from Czechoslovakia, from Havel, an ex-prime minister there, that says that at some point he mentions that they asked some workers to put a big, nice graphic behind their store saying, "Workers of the world unite." And of course, the poor guy that is selling tomatoes, have no idea why that thing should be there, but it was much easier for his life to just put it there. So that's, by and large, his excuse of how we end up here. We had to go into a state where we had to accept anything because that was making our life much easier. It's quite different from all the others, and especially from the quantitative chapters that are there in the book. It's equally important, but this one I do believe strongly that has a very special color. And here I will give just to one small hint of what comes next. One of the things that was coming a lot was, okay, what do we need to do from now on? And we thought one of the things we definitely need to think about, and it's definitely in the agenda, is taxation. Okay, so how do we use taxes to restart the economy? How do we use taxation as a growth factor? So the next thing is we had from Palgrave and now Springer Palgrave, we have a follow-up book that is going to be in a similar format, practitioners, academics contributed on the next thing, which is how taxation can be used as a growth factor rather than as a strictly distribution and welfare. So I'm done.
Thank you very much. Yes. So we've been given a very clear presentation of the book, and I would invite Dimitris to give us his comments.
Oh, thank you.
All right. So, thank you for asking, for inviting me to discuss this very interesting book. So, quick summary. Actually, you heard a fairly organized, very organized kind of presentation of the structure of the book. So, this is just a repetition of what you just heard. So, the book provides perspectives on the Eurozone crisis and its manifestation in Greece. It has three parts. So part one is consists of some chapters that provide the practitioners' perspectives on Europe, on various issues, mainly Eurozone-wide issues. pertaining to monetary policy, some of them, to financial stability, others, and to fiscal policy, others. Part two is more, goes more specifically on Greece, mainly on kind of issues pertaining to macro, fiscal policy, and debt management. And part three is written by academics, and this kind of perspectives by academics on Eurozone-wide issues. So mainly on fiscal policy and on the long-run architecture of the Eurozone. So it's a nice feature of this book is that it has a kind of complementary perspectives by academics and practitioners, which actually I think is very useful to kind of to have when they kind of get to work together on things. So, and I'm glad to have the opportunity, have been given the opportunity to discuss the book. So now, okay, if I were to go over each chapter of the book and kind of go in in-depth discussion, I could have taken you the next 4 hours or so, have to be in this room, so that's not possible. And so I have to just to pick a few chapters and I will try to kind of go more into in-depth in just a few chapters. And mainly pose some questions for the authors, kind of try to challenge them a bit on some issues. I mean, that's my role in the discussion, try to challenge them a bit. And perhaps we can have this as part of the discussion, or I'm sure that also the audience will raise some questions. So I will go to, I will spend most of my discussion on chapters 6 and 7 pertaining to Greece. And I will say a few comments at the end, kind of some provocative comments on some chapters about Eurozone architecture. All right, so chapter 6, so it talks about the buildup of external debt. You see, I chose the chapters that are written by the by the book's editor, so they're here, that I would nag them. So, okay, so chapter 6 is about the buildup of external debt in Greece. And what is done in that chapter is essentially it regresses. I mean, the main kind of thing that this chapter does is it regresses Greece's current account deficit on a number of variables. Essentially, try to explain what drove the increase in the deficit post euro entry and the increase in foreign debt. So on real effective exchange rate, so that's a measure of competitiveness, fiscal deficit, the income gap with other Eurozone countries, the notion being that if Greece is kind of given this, it has lower GDP per capita, it could borrow in order to maybe invest and kind of reach the standard income standards of the other countries, and also on a measure of financial liberalization and GDP growth as well. So the findings is that these variables explain a significant part of the variation. So in particular, a significant part of the increase in Greece's foreign indebtedness following euro entry. So my comment here, and this is what I would kind of like to throw a question to the authors, is that the effect may not be causal. So let me just explain myself. In other words, the chain of causality may not be that may not necessarily be that, for example, the loss of competitiveness caused Greece to borrow more from abroad, but instead, lower interest rates fall after Eurozone entry, stimulated borrowing from abroad, allowed Greece to borrow more easily from abroad, and this is what led to the loss of competitiveness, or even what kind of facilitated borrowing by the government. Actually, this is a viewpoint that is quite forcefully argued in this paper by Charles Wiplos, which I think is an interesting paper. Somehow he kind of made some very similar point. Just show you a couple of graphs. This is the stunning decline in interest rates following in the run-up to euro entry. So you see how interest rates, this is the nominal short-term interest rate in Greece. You see how high it was in the 80s and the 90s, and then starting in 95, starting actually a bit before 95, it goes down to reach levels, kind of euro zone levels. Now, Greece did not have external debt, any significant external debt until 2000. This is the blue line here is the external debt. You see how fast it rises after 2000. This is what the authors are focusing on, really, in that chapter, kind of why this rose so much. Now, however, for example, in the 90s, Greece was coming after a period of big government deficits in the 80s and even in the early 90s, but did not have a foreign debt, had very little. This is the government deficit is the red line, foreign debt is the blue line. So, in some sense, what really kind of, I mean, how can I say? So this is about an argument about the causality. It's not necessarily that the government deficits were driving the foreign indebtedness, which is what may have happened here, but it's just just the mere fact of entering the Eurozone that drove foreign indebtedness, and maybe this facilitated kind of further borrowing by the government up here. Anyway, so that's something that maybe the authors can comment a bit. I would like to spend some time on chapter 7 on fiscal multipliers, which I thought was really interesting chapter to read. So what is done there is they estimate the relationship between GDP growth, government revenue, and government spending. So and essentially the fiscal multipliers, which are effectively the effects of changes in revenue or spending on GDP, what they find is that actually they are larger for government spending. So if the government cuts spending, this could shrink GDP by more than if the government raises taxes. So, and actually the other finding is that they are particularly large for cuts in public investment. So, so among the components of spending, the one that is the most damaging to economic growth to cut is public investment, as opposed to primary items such as wages and pensions. Although still, even these items, cutting wages and pensions can be more recessionary in their regressions than raising taxes. So an implication, although the authors are very careful about this implication, so they qualify it a lot, is that it may be better to raise taxes or curb evasion, tax evasion, than to cut expenditure. So anyway, so this is something that I would like to spend a little bit of time on. I would be a bit critical of that finding, at least in the current context, in the current environment in Greece. So just to give you a little bit of background, let's look at some of the data. So so this is current revenue and expenditure, so not kind of does not include investment, does not include revenue from privatization, so it's kind of current kind of so wages, for example, for expenditure is wages, pensions, for expenditure, for revenue is taxes, kind of regular kind of items every year. So you see here that these two were balanced in around euro entry. Then after euro entry, there was a revenue went down as a proportion of GDP by about, in a moderate amount, about 2 to 3% went down, this percentage of GDP here. Expenditure was fairly stable until 2006, and then it exploded. Kind of this is where we went to the big deficits at the beginning of the crisis. So essentially, the big government deficit in Greece was really driven by a fast increase in expenditure. Now, what happened since the crisis, and all these things are kind of nicely explained in the book, is that actually you can see it here. Expenditure did not really go down much at the beginning for the first 2 or 3 years of the memorandum, whatever, of the adjustment program. On the other hand, revenue increased. So there was an effort to arrive. There were tax raises mainly. This continued. And then eventually, from 2012, 2013, expenditure started going down. So there were some real cuts started taking place. Now, by the way, much of the action in the expenditure since the crisis was not driven by changes in the interest payments. This is the breakdown of current expenditure in interest, which is the red, and the rest, which is the blue. So interest remained a roughly unchanged amount. But so the cuts were... These cuts here were mainly driven by just wages, pensions, other items. So anyway, so I summarize this here in these conclusions that about the behavior of revenue and expenditure before the crisis and during the crisis. Also, it's worth noting, also this is nicely put in the chapter, that public investment was cut quite a lot as a percentage of GDP just after the crisis started, just at the beginning of the adjustment programs. So effectively, just to conclude, to summarize all this picture, the adjustment since 2009 was driven primarily by tax rises and cuts in public investment, especially at the early stages, not as much as cuts in expenditure. Now, so my view, and this is where I would like the authors to comment on it a bit, I mean, because... Anyway, so the adjustment should probably have relied less on tax rises and less on cuts to public investment and more on cuts to current expenditure. Because, I mean, okay, so now, why less on tax rises? Because this might have been less recessionary and cutting public investment would be particularly damaging to future growth, as the authors actually do find. So there is this paper by Alessina and Ardania that shows that adjustment programs in which most of the savings come from spending cuts yield smaller declines in GDP than when they come from the savings come from tax rises. So actually they advocate this kind of rule of thumb of two-thirds spending cuts and one-third tax rises. So in Greece what happened, it was more tax rises was more than half of the adjustment, was about 60% of the adjustment between 2009 and 2014, was almost all of the adjustment until 2011. So, and actually, if we were to look at policy kind of going forward, and I was particularly interested in the author's view on that question, so it seems that there is, right now in Greece, there is overtaxation. So, like for example, tax rate for corporate income is 29%, the EU average is 22.5%. So significantly lower. Neighboring countries to Greece have much lower tax rates than Greece. Like Bulgaria has 10%. I mean, it's our corporate tax rates. Cyprus 12.5. Top rate for personal income is also significantly higher in Greece than the EU average. VAT is just a bit higher, let's say comparable to the EU average. The other important kind of difference is about the labor tax. So. What is called the implicit tax rate on labor, which is the sum of income taxes and pension contributions, is among the highest in the OECD for Greece. So somehow it seems, and that's my view, is that one would need like powerful pro-growth policies to restart the Greek economy. And I would say this has to include a significant reduction in tax rates and pension contributions, and very importantly also very stable tax environment for a horizon of a decade, and an increase in public investment. So now, let me come back to chapter 7. So I'm totally sympathetic to their finding that public investment cuts are the most recessionary way for a fiscal adjustment. I'm less convinced about the finding that tax rises are less recessionary than spending cuts. Perhaps this is true in the... Anyway, I would really be interested to understand exactly what is driving this in the data. In any case, the authors are cautious about, express some caution about the policy implications of that. And anyway, I would like to have their thoughts on this issue. Finally, okay, let me now just give some, just one page of comments on the Eurozone-wide issues. So chapters 2 and 14 talk about policies for a more stable Eurozone. They emphasize two kind of general areas. One is the fiscal coordination and monitoring. That's chapter 2 is essentially almost about that. Chapter 14 is part about that and part about the banking union. Banking union, which includes a single kind of centralized regulation, bank resolution, again at the European level as opposed to the national level, and same for deposit insurance. So my take on that, and I don't have enough time to go into depth, but I just put these things just maybe for discussion. I think that banking union is essential. Some progress has been made, but more needs to be done. Banking union does require a loss of sovereignty. Essentially, states have to lose control of their banks. You have to take some of their control away. I think this can be a good thing for Greece, and I think for other countries as well. I mean, so not just for Greece. I mean, in many countries, somehow some of the effects have been damaging that the states have had on their banking systems. So, I'm skeptical as to what can be achieved on the fiscal front, kind of this, all this monitoring and kind of how much monitoring centralized monitoring by the Eurozone of its member states' budgets can how effective it can be. I would be more sympathetic to strengthening market monitoring with a clear and efficient regime for sovereign bankruptcy, such as did not exist before the crisis. So, kind of things were being made on the fly, in particular. I mean, make it easy for sovereigns to go bankrupt if they cannot repay their debts. That's it. Make it kind of a bankruptcy code that does not make life easy for the holdouts. Does not allow them obviously this needs to be coupled with some other change at the Eurozone level, such as some kind of form of cyclical transfer, such as perhaps European level unemployment insurance and other changes. But in any case, that's, again, I just put this perspective out for some discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Dimitri, for those very helpful comments.
First of all, I wonder if the authors would like to make any responses to what Dimitris has been saying.
Should I say a few things about the comments on chapter 7?
Okay.
Very insightful, and thank you very much for these comments. Of course, there is a big debate about the optimal mix of fiscal policy, if there is such a thing as an optimal mix. So the question is to cut expenditure or increase taxes. And the clarification we'd like to make here is that the empirical study measures dollar to dollar. It shows, provides an estimate of what is going to be the impact, the potential impact of a 1 euro cut in public expenditure on wages, pensions, or alternatively, a 1 euro increase in revenues, and what the effect of such discretionary policies would be on output. How many, for instance, euros output will decline per 1 euro increase in tax revenue. So the chapter clarifies that the findings of stronger fiscal multipliers in expenditure cuts do not provide an outright call for higher taxation, but emphasize the need to cut tax evasion. And to give you an example, the Greek government is currently negotiating with institutions in the context of the first review of the new bailout program, and it appears that tax rates would increase further. For instance, the higher tax rate for incomes above 50,000 euros will be raised from 42% currently to 50%, which is, I mean, if you also include the solidarity tax, which will become permanent, and various other, you know, contributions, social security contribution, the effective tax rate for an individual that earns over 50,000 euros per annum will be close to 65%, 70%. But, you know, if you look at the number of taxpayers who declare incomes above 50,000 euros, the number is ridiculously small. It's close to 10,000.
Less than 20% of the taxpayers.
Which is ridiculous because nobody declares income. So there is a lot of tax evasion in Greece. So the implication of that is that the tax burden is placed on the usual suspects, mainly wage earners who cannot hide incomes. So that's the clarification we'd like to make, that basically the study measures fiscal multipliers euro to euro, dollar to dollar. But I would agree with the rest of your arguments that this is an issue that deserves very close explanation, clear explanation, and close monitoring. So I don't know if my other colleagues...
You practically covered everything. The only thing that I would like to say is that the advantage of having a good discussion is that can advertise your products even without knowing him. So it's good that we heard these comments, especially on the issue of taxation and the upcoming book that we have. But I would like to make two comments to further talk about this issue. Three words, not but end. The idea presented in the paper, and Platon already said, that is not to raise taxes, certainly to curb tax evasion, but there is a but here that reflects to the historical evolution of the Greek crisis, that the depth of the fiscal tightening that was imposed from the first MOUs was higher than what it should have been. And this is what the study shows, that if you have so much larger multipliers on expenditure than those that were calculated to impose the MOU, you would have made a mistake, and we did. And there was a mistake. And Greece cannot raise taxes right now because of low growth, and could not raise taxes before because of high evasion. So everything that Dimitris said is certainly accurate. We would like to address this. That's why I would like to talk about taxation next, because there is a dear need to talk about taxation, because the other fiscal tools have run out of steam. We cannot use fiscal expansions via spending, and the only things that are available to us now are tools that relate to taxation. So thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Okay. Thanks. We don't have so much time. Perhaps I can now then open it to the audience, to a number of distinguished guests and experts in the audience. So can we take Antigone here? Yes.
Well, thanks for the very interesting presentation. My question is, while going through your book, I realized that the main analysis stops before the third bailout program. And I've been thinking, what's your take now? I mean, some of the points you raised concerning the dramatic pace of the short-term adjustment that maybe were more harmful than expected. Now that the bailout is extended for another 3 years, and would you think that some of your issues that you raised were taken into account while designing the third program? And a small remark for Dimitri Janos, one of your slides talked about parents, married people with families in single parent households. This is not whole.
In single income.
Single income.
A single income.
Okay, thanks. Can we take three together? Thanks.
I guess my question is for Platon Monakoussis on the chapter from Schopel. You mentioned you're talking about market regression, and I think the presentation there was suggesting that market regression was a negative side effect of the non-conventional monetary policies that were followed. And I would like to ask to what extent we can see this as a side effect rather than as a purpose, the policy objective itself, because the high volatility and high risk, short-term risk, was diagnosed to be the cause of the problem, you know, what triggered the crisis, or at least could create the conditions for the crisis. So isn't it only natural that the policy response would be to try to reduce the volatility and try to shift financial behavior to longer term risk? So I don't understand what is the concept of financial regression in that context. If you could explain.
Okay, good, thanks. Another question before we move on?
I'm wondering if Greece is still in a state of denial. I'm a believer in the European project, but it seems to me abundantly clear that the German current account surplus is here to stay, that there will be no substantial annual transfers from wealthy European nations to those that require it. Is it not time to think the unthinkable, that actually leaving the euro is the only solution to avoiding a very long period of austerity? And is this not a very difficult thought, but one that would be actually the only solution once you've accepted that the European Union is fundamentally not going to change?
Thank you. That's a very fashionable question in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, I'm a believer in the European Union.
Yeah, yeah. We'll come back. There's three questions. Who'd like to pick up any of those questions?
Let me first try to address Antigone's. And actually, I had a warning by Antigone that she was going to raise a question about the third bailout, because we share the same office. And actually, I was fortunate or unfortunate to have a meeting a few days earlier with a troika in the institution in Athens, and I was trying to convince them that the new proposals to further increase taxes will not yield significant results and will be counterproductive. I think that certain elements of the current program are in the same direction. For instance, the completion of structural reforms in the domestic product markets. Definitely something needs to be done with the social security system, because the social security system in Greece is very expensive. Absorbs resources close to 17% of GDP, which is an extraordinary amount. The central government budget pays around 10% of GDP on an annual basis in terms of transfers to support the social security system. So the social security system is definitely a system that requires very aggressive reforms. So the social security system reform is in the right direction, in my view. It's going to be painful. It's going to create a lot of social reactions, but is an absolute necessity. But certain other elements of the new bailout program are totally in the wrong direction, in my view, and are going to prove counterproductive. I mean, the further increase in taxation will increase tax evasion and will not increase tax revenues. That is almost a tautology for me. I'm certain we're going to see a decline in tax revenues. So if I would like to connect, to make a link with what Dimitris noted, I mean, one of his questions, I think that the implementation of a lower tax rate, especially on corporations, would be beneficial for the country for sure. So there are certain elements in the current program that are clear in the right direction, but several elements are highly problematic. Apparently, the third bailout program is a disaster for the country. However, there is a silver lining, if you like, and the explanation is as follows. What the country needs at this point is some period of tranquility, some period of stability, a confirmation to financial, to foreign investors that the country will remain well-financed. Some additional debt relief will be provided. And the only way to succeed in doing that is to complete especially the first program review, because the first program review incorporates a great amount of conditionality. So the question is, and the challenge is, to basically successfully complete the first program review, pass the review through Parliament, which is another challenge. You are an ex-politician, so you know better than me. But a quick agreement would be beneficial, although certain parts of the program and certain areas of the new program are totally in the wrong direction. And very quickly to make a clarification about Mr. Monastiriotis's question, probably I need to make a clarification here. I would fully agree with you that compression of volatility and extended period of lower and stable interest rates was the main, let's say, aim of monetary authorities at the first place. So the side effects were included, for instance, the addiction to this environment and the implications of this addiction. There is a lot of debate currently about the potential ramifications of negative deposit rates and their effect on the stability of the financial system. In my opinion, negative deposit rates, provided by the European Central Bank, are quite problematic. In addition to that, the marginal effects of quantitative easing on the economy are diminishing. And in addition to that, it is very difficult to exit QE, quantitative easing policies, without triggering significant implications for financial market stability and the economy. There was a study 2 years ago by S&P, if I remember well, discussing the situation in Japan. In Japan, over the last 15 years, domestic banks and financial institutions doubled their holdings of domestic sovereign bonds. And there was an analysis that an even small increase in long-term yields by, say, 200 basis points could create serious capitalization issues for the domestic banking system. So all these unconventional, non-conventional policies may have longer-term implications, and this is apparent in the most recent environment, and the instability, the prospect of higher interest rate by the Federal Reserve, the instability all these expectations create in the current trajectory.
Okay, I want just to give a short answer also to Adiwoni. Now here I have to go to the housekeeping rules of publishing a book, which you know very well and probably better than me. The book was deadline in March, so it's very interesting the dates. Okay, we're talking about 25th of January was the elections, and then 2 months, 1 month later, the book was deadlined. Some of the chapters, most of the chapters, we tried to put it as late as possible to catch up with the things. They were written in December, November, and the book came out in September, after the referendum, after the second elections, after. So we were very proactive there, and we decided to write, with the help of the publishers, a very, very aggressive afterword, which is in page 329, that aggressive, which I had to ask the co-editors if they really want to put their names there. So we put the names there, all three. Usually you don't. In the afterword, you just leave it as is, because it's a statement. And I'll just read something there to see how worried we are about the things that were happening, which... It's things like, is there any meaning to the voices of alternative economics, or are we finally done with backward-looking social experiments? So are we going to leave the markets anymore, take any more punishment from the policy applications of self-proclaimed economists? So I don't know how coloring is that, but, you know, that's the fact. So things were happening, and we're trying to catch up with things that were happening. And actually, the last chapter from Michael Argyrou in Cardiff, it's a bit forecasting what's going to happen. So he was saying that if there is no more tighter banking union, things will go even worse for the banks, and there will have to be more and more bailouts until we have a proper banking union. And these things have been happening. So in a way, I think we did a good job in trying to catch up with something that was almost impossible, given that you need 6-7 months to publish the book from the time it's really closed. So that's just as an argument there.
Dimitri, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on this.
We haven't answered the question about whether Grexit would be...
Yeah, I will come to
that. Oh, I wanted to also comment on that, but I'm happy to...
Please, okay.
Yeah, so let me comment a bit on your question. So, first of all, let me say that Ireland is expected to grow next year at almost 5%. So being part of the Eurozone does not mean low growth, necessarily. The other thing that I want to say is that you know, many of the Greece's challenging reforms have to happen whether it stays in the Eurozone or not. I mean, like what was mentioned was about tax reform, raise this abysmally high, lower these very high tax rates instead of raising them, or like pension reform. I mean, these things have to happen. Greece has to balance its books whether it's part of the Eurozone or not. So it's irrelevant whether it stays in the Eurozone or not. These things have to happen. If you look at the terminus of long-term growth, such as, for example, the quality of the educational system, the quality of the quality of the justice system, the expenditure in R&D, the quality of product-market regulation, Greece is doing fairly poorly, for example, in rankings, I don't know, EU rankings or OECD rankings. These things, again, have to happen, whether it exits the euro or not. So the real question is Greece going to reform more easily as part of the euro or as outside the euro? My view is that it's going to reform more easily as part of the euro, and I think that I'm kind of very convinced about that, because there is the pressure there is the outside pressure to reform. If Greece is left, if Greece just goes alone and kind of just has its own currency, all this pressure is going to disappear. We saw how much pressure Greece was under. The only reforms that happened in Greece since euro entry were the ones that happened after 2009, effectively. And these reforms happened just because there was this outside pressure. So given that Greece wants to say somehow, for some reason, so far it wants to stay in the euro, its politicians would have to accept this, we're going to benefit from this pressure because the politicians would have to do some reforms. And eventually, hopefully, there will be a kind of more consensus even within the country to the reforms. But I don't see how the reforms are going to happen outside of the euro.
Okay, thanks.
Just yeah, one comment. I now have to express my personal opinion. I do agree that Greece is still in a state of denial for various reasons, cultural, historical, but also because we cannot really believe that a man is rich when they make 50k euros, when in UK you need 150k pounds, which is a stronger currency, to start getting that 50% tax. So it's an oxymoron anyway. So for various reasons, but mostly for fundamental structural, which so I fully agree. However, the contributors, they do state very strongly that the elephant in the room is Germany. So maybe Europe is better without Germany. So I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay, good, thanks. Other questions, other comments? Can we take the lady over here, please? Other comments? Can you just wait for the microphone because it's being recorded?
The question is really, we're talking about micro, and I presume the book is quite delves around the macro. And as Mr. Vagino said, it was quite nice to hear a few micro issues. It does seem to me that the majority of the issues we have in Greece is micro and not macro. I mean, I can understand why the macro issues would have some causality, but if we look at countries like Ireland, as you mentioned, or even Cyprus, or other sort of countries that went through these problems from 2008, 9, 10, almost all of those countries are out of the woods.
Thank you. Can we take the Talia over here, please? Thank you.
Just a micro question. As a political psychologist, I've been talking to young people from the last 2 or 3 months. So apart from some who were very fortunate and who were living in huge houses with Mercedes, the majority was having quite a problem to lead a normal life. Normal life meaning facing costs that have to do with education, with elderly family. And we talk a lot about tax evasion, but the services for which people have to pay every day are not of very good quality. So they have to pay, for example, maybe school is free, but they have to pay for this fee or for their children. So if they go to the doctor, they have to pay extra money to get operated. So for the same salary that you might have in Germany and in Greece, the Greeks have to pay a lot of things aside. So in a way, they don't get better. So the escape on one side, they have to pay on the other to do basic things.
So it's rational to evade taxes. Who would like to respond?
I can have a go on the last question.
Please.
Since you're talking from the perspective of psychology, I can reverse the question and say, how about the tax suckers? I call them the tax suckers, me included. So I work a lot, meaning that we pay all our taxes, and we know that we cannot avoid paying all our taxes, and still the system does not give us anything back. Does this justify the rest of... because this is an argument that I've heard that at various levels, that because we cannot get anything back from the system, then we should not be paying our taxes. But...
No.
that's what I understood. I mean, in terms of tax evasion, so there are problems from everybody, right?
And on the other points?
Yes, if I may try to address the question about, you know, macro and micro.
Yes.
I've heard your argument, and I think that there are many, let's say, micro issues that need to be resolved, you know, the working of markets. But in my opinion, something that also relates to the potential or the proposal or the outlook of a potential exit has to do with the quality of institutions. And in my opinion, the major problem with Greece is the lack of the lack of institutions, be it fiscal institutions, policy institutions. So, in my opinion, one needs to look at the quality of institutions, the credibility of institutions, and you cannot do that without being a part of the euro area. So the euro area provides an anchor, provides a disciplinary mechanism to lead the country towards, you know, the creation of credible institutions, basically. And this is an issue that has to do also with democratic legitimacy and accountability. So it's a broader issue. But definitely, you know, we talk a lot about micro imbalances because the starting position, the initial conditions of the country were much worse than in other crisis hit economies. So the adjustment had to be much more significant. And inevitably, when you talk about, you know, the crisis and the impact of the crisis, you need to look at macro variables and macro issues, external deficits, fiscal deficits, and things like that. So that would be my
just to pick up that last question and link it to the state of denial, I think what you're finding, there are big experts of the state of denial in Greece. So people in Greece still think that the only way you can have good education is through private education. People still think that the only way you can get into the university is through private tuition, while they should be doing exactly the opposite. They should be going and pushing the public school, which they pay taxes for, to become a better school. And to give you the exact thing here...
Isn't it a short-term, long-term thing?
It's not just long-term, short-term. It's just also understanding where you are and what are your options. Because I live in Lancaster, okay? I live in Lancaster, I have three children. I have a good school, Ofsted, all one. If I come to the south, the chance to get all three children in one school, to being all of them Ofsted one, are almost zero. So I know that if I come to the south, I have to pay private schools. It's as simple as that. And that's why I'm staying in the north. So that in Greece is not an option. They don't discuss that. In Greece, they say, no, I'll get them in the private school no matter what. So there is a state, there is still a state of denial. We want to live in a certain way while the world has changed a bit.
Anyone else? More comments or questions? We've just got time for a last quick round, if there are any.
I was very interested in your comments about the state of denial, and I'm very interested in whether you see some of those factors playing a role in other markets in the EU, particularly the London market or housing.
I don't understand the question.
So I think we talked about the Northern Rock, we talked about lending.
Yeah.
Oh, I see, okay.
Lending against income ratios. And it's very, very interesting to hear those things.
Okay. So the state of denial is something which is experienced in other places.
Yeah.
Okay.
And to what extent do you see that as being relevant in other European countries?
Thank you. Other comments, questions? Gentleman here, please. Oh, I'm sorry. We'll take both of you. You go first.
Another slightly roundabout question, and I hope people will see where it comes back to. When Ronald Reagan ran for president in 1980, he was going to cut taxes and balance the budget. And the intellectual underpinning for doing those at the same time was a thing called the Laffer Curve, the work of a not very intellectually respectable right-wing ideologue economist named Arthur Laffer, which argued that if tax rates went too high, revenue would go down. And though nobody remembers Arthur Laffer much today, if you look at what happened with taxes and growth in the West, in the developed world in the 1980s and 90s, and compare it to the 1970s, I think you have to reach a conclusion that probably Laffer was right about this. So when talking about raising taxes in Greece back to levels which were commonplace in the developed world in the late 1970s, do we need to resurrect the Laffer curve and maybe give it some intellectual respectability after all?
Okay. Ronald Reagan is more intellectual than we thought.
Just quickly, I want to say that going back to denial, one thing is like going back to denial is that people want to stay focused on what can give you dealt back by the past. So hold on to what they have and don't change. Mm. But my question effectively now is on public investment, I think it's one point that you raised. What is the total amount of public investment required now, assuming that we can budget the tax evasion, in order to go back to growth or numbers which are sustainable, please?
Thank you. If you could try to answer quickly these points, please.
Should I address the last question? Public investment in Greece has declined dramatically. It's currently well below the euro area average, close to 1.5% of GDP, and compares with the euro area average, which should be close to 2.5 to 3% of the GDP. Of course, public investment is always, you know, cuts in public investment is always preferred by the politicians because it's the easiest way to reduce expenditure. But, you know, unfortunately, it appears that public investment has large multipliers. And this is also an empirical finding of our analysis. You know, if I had to provide a figure, not specifically for public investment, but for, you know, total investment, I would say the total investment would need to increase by at least 10% of GDP, so as to basically, you know, allow a convergence towards the euro area average, which is currently close to 19 to 20%, and to provide jobs, attract FDI, and provide a boost to exports. Because, you know, a return to sustainable and positive growth rates in Greece without foreign direct investment and higher exports is impossible. You cannot rely any further on consumption, because total consumption in Greece, public and private, remains close to 90%, which is much higher than the euro area average. So the restructuring of the economy has not been completed yet. We need a boost in investment, foreign direct investment, because domestic savings are not enough to finance these boost in investments, FDI, and higher exports, you know, by boosting especially non-wage related competitiveness, which is another issue and relates to a comment made by Dimitris.
Thank you.
Can I say that? And these things are first order important, and they can be done perfectly well within the euro. There is nothing wrong about being in the euro and doing these things. I just wanted to add this. Mm.
Any other? Okay, I think we are.
Is it possible to give the, because he's one of the contributors, Sunday, to give him.
I'm sorry. Please,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry.
If you just wait for the microphone, it's this is going to be the last.
It's just that I had a private conversation with Dimitris, which actually raised the issues that are being raised now. Mm-hmm. In that we confuse when you talk in these macro terms, the micro implications. It's not so much tax rate. There is a difference between tax rate and tax take. Increase in revenue and increase in the rate is different.
Yeah.
Cutting government expenditure and cutting government expenditure on certain types of things, even current expenditure, if you get rid of the teachers, then people would look for private schools. Mm. So unless we look at the micro of how government expenditure is distributed, whether it is cut or increased, is not the issue. How taxes are structured. And these are the issues rather than the kind of aggregate things that we can capture in our regressions, and about which the IMF, the EU, the Troika, and including, I'm afraid, Greek government officials are concerned with. So it's essentially a discipline of breaking out of economists' obsession with macroeconomic regressions is a necessary condition for any kind of economic policy to succeed.
Thank you. Okay. Unless there's any
We left out the Laffer curve, and I was waiting for somebody to talk because I thought he would say something about taxes. And the taxation relates both to levels and rates, and as very well was put right now by Sandy. And let me give you a very simple example on the issues that are raised by the idea of the Laffer curve, which might be right. We don't. I cannot say offhand, and there's another book coming, of course. There is a very popular news item. If you look at it at the blogs, you will find it, that says that the billionaire government, I think of Minnesota or some other U.S. state, raised taxes on the rich, and that increased revenue for the state. However, if you read below, you will find out that the raise was from a rate of 7.8% to 9.8%. So these are already low rates, right? And rich were defined as individuals that had more than $150,000 annual income, single for one individual, or a family for income above $250,000. So this sets the stage for when we are talking about taxation, and especially taxation in Greece, that initial conditions matter. Right now, initial conditions in Greece and in Europe are very bad, and the levels of incomes are low, so you cannot even be talking about the rates that we are talking right now. If you're in the case of the Minnesota, let's call it the Minnesota case, then certainly, yes, you can raise from 8 to 10. Not a problem there. You can actually raise the take, as Santi said. If the scope is to raise the revenue, yes, you can do it by raising rates. But from which level are you going to do that? And there is a level and there is a rate after which revenues decrease. But all these, hopefully, we are going to be examining in our next volume. Thank you.
Well, excellent. Perhaps you need very generous tax incentives to live in Minnesota. Anyway, we've now had a preview that there is another book coming out, which we look forward to. As you leave the lecture theatre, the publishers have a desk, and you can obtain the book at a generous discount, so do not miss that opportunity. Can I thank each of the contributors and my colleague Dimitris for his very helpful comments. Thank you for your contributions as well. Can you please join me in thanking our panellists?